Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's not just Friday. It's Follow-Up Friday, where we dig a little deeper into things that came up throughout the week. Today, we'll follow up on two interesting stories, neither of which is exactly over. In 5 minutes or so, we're going to be taking calls from people who grew up near the ocean, in particular the Gulf Coast, Southern California, or anywhere else there's offshore drilling. Earlier this week, we were talking about the BP oil spill and the tar balls washing up on shore throughout the Gulf region. We got several comments from people who said that this is nothing new. Beachgoers have always had to contend with clumps of oil getting stuck to the bottom of their feet. So if you have a story about tar balls, you can start calling now. 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can go to the Brian Lehrer page on WNYC.org and give us your comments. In the meantime, let's follow up on a court case we discussed a few weeks ago on the show. Quinnipiac University was recently sued by members of its own volleyball program, which the university was planning to shut down. The school was arguing that the cheerleading squad would fulfill its Title IX obligations to provide equal athletic opportunities for both men and women. The cheerleading program is much cheaper than the volleyball team, and the university was looking to cut costs while still complying with Title IX. The case became a de facto trial around the question, is cheerleading a sport? Well, earlier this week, the judge offered his ruling. Here to discuss it is Lisa Matz, Director of Public Policy and Government Relations at AAUW, formerly known as the American Association of University Women. Lisa, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So tell us, what did the judge rule?
You know, it was a pretty straightforward decision. Essentially, what he said was that competitive cheer was not yet a sport, either recognized by the Department of Education and Office of Civil Rights, by the NCAA, that it was not something that was organized, and that truthfully, under the letter and spirit of Title IX, it says pretty clearly that sports have to be competitive and not necessarily auxiliary to another sport. And so he essentially held what current law states, but he did it pretty straightforwardly, and I also think sensitively, because we don't want necessarily people to be thinking that this doesn't mean that we don't think the women involved in these programs are athletic. It's about whether this particular sport provides the kind of opportunity that should be counted towards compliance with Title IX.
But, you know, and I think for those of us who are glee addicts, mm-hmm. You know, I've learned a thing or two about cheerleading. I always thought cheerleading was just something that, you know, a bunch of mostly women or girls did on the sideline of a sports game. And turns out, I have learned from Glee, that there's a whole competitive aspect involved. So what is it that makes it not a sport, according to this ruling?
Well, yeah, one of the things that the judge said was that this particular sport was not organized enough, was not really part of kind of the sports establishment. I mean, they're not recognized by the NCAA. They don't have a national championship. There is an organization that some people join, but in fact, there are only four Division I schools nationwide that treat competitive cheer as a varsity sport. So it's not like volleyball, where, you know, you kind of have volleyball pretty standard at a lot of schools. It is something that is more unusual. And part of what we're trying to do here with Title IX is ensure that women have opportunities. We don't want schools kind of engaging in this roster management sleight of hand, so to speak, in order to come into compliance. It needs to be a good faith effort. And it was very clear that Quinnipiac wanted to cut their budget, that they felt volleyball was too expensive, and that they wanted to try to slide this in, even though they already had the team. It's not like they just started it, to see if they could get away with this being their Title IX compliance program. And that just doesn't work.
Isn't there a sort of catch-22 there, though? I mean, if you don't count cheerleading as a sport, how does it ever become a sport that is sponsored by more colleges?
Well, you know what? I actually think that one of the things that's happening is that it's moving towards that. I think it's going to be many years before it gets there. But the fact that they're just now starting an association that has six schools joined to it, they're just now thinking about having a national championship. It needs to be something that is much more common and widely adhered to or used by schools, both at the college level, but quite frankly at the high school level as well, because that's the feeder into these kinds of programs.
Has the goal of Title IX changed since it was first implemented? You know, if the idea was to provide competitive opportunities for women to be part of a team and receive institutional support, you know, there's an argument, isn't there, that a 30-person cheer squad provides more opportunities than an 11-person volleyball program?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, I certainly think it's worth a discussion. At the same time, part of what we're looking for is that true, authentic athletic experience. Are they giving scholarships to folks on the cheer team like they might on the volleyball team? Are they actually doing a full range of competitive meets, going to tournaments, away travel, national championships, and so forth? So we're really looking for the same kind of quality sports experience that men and boys get for women. And I think, again, we're not talking about that cheerleading isn't necessarily an athletic endeavor. I mean, you will see that lots of groups who are very pro-Title IX certainly support other what we would call aesthetic sports, like diving and figure skating and gymnastics. So it's not like it can't get there. The point is that it can't be ancillary to another sport, and it needs to truly have the full range of a competitive sport experience.
A lot of mid-sized universities are really under financial stress. Do you think that we're going to be seeing more things like this, or does this ruling preclude that?
You know, the budget question is such a tough one because you're right. So many schools are having trouble making ends meet these days. And quite frankly, at the end of the day, people go to college to get an education, not necessarily to watch a sports meet, although obviously that can be something that enhances the college experience. So part of what we've been saying is certainly
I'm sure that's fighting words.
but well, you know what? I'm an Ohio State Buckeye fan, so trust me. I know about good fans. But, you know, I think part of what we're trying to do here is to say schools can make whatever decisions they need to make in terms of budgets, but don't scapegoat Title IX. Don't say, well, I had to cut this men's program in order to be in compliance with Title IX, or I had to cut this volleyball program in order to make it cheaper but still be in compliance with Title IX. Talk about it for what it really is, that it's a difficult budget situation. It's a difficult choice. We're sorry that we had to make it, but it doesn't have anything to do with Title IX. People still need to be in compliance, but you don't have to do that by cutting teams. If they do cut teams, that's the university's choice. It has nothing to do with Title IX.
How do you think Title IX is doing, you know, lo these many years after it was passed? And I'll tell you a little story. At my daughter's middle school, they did not have a girls' soccer team because they said there weren't enough other middle school girls' teams to play against. So I'm sort of, you know, wondering, like, this is 2010, how effective Title IX has been.
You know, that's an excellent question because I think Title IX has been quite effective at the collegiate level. And part of the reason for that is because we have the NCAA, which has supported Title IX, and we also have something called the Equity in Athletics Disclosure Act, which requires colleges to report data on who is playing in their programs, who gets the scholarships, all that good stuff. And while I think sometimes those numbers are, quite frankly, manipulated, they engage in roster management and put, you know, 60 people on a crew team to try and make up for football, at the same time, we don't have such requirements in high school or middle school. And so part of what we see is that even well-meaning people potentially are discriminating against girls and they don't even know it. So one of the things AUW has been working on is a high school data bill. We're trying to get it in the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Ed Act, and it would essentially, you know, it's a minor bill, but something that could have far-reaching consequences where high schools would need to report the kind of data in a much more minor way that colleges do so that people could look at it. You know, I think oftentimes, you know, transparency can be the best disinfectant, and it's a great way for well-meaning people, people of goodwill, to do what they need to do about Title IX and be in compliance. And I'll tell you what, you have never seen a more ferocious Title IX advocate than a dad with a daughter. So
I think
it's a great way to get people involved.
Thank you so much. Lisa Matz is Director of Public Policy and Government Relations at AAUW. We've been speaking about a Connecticut judge's ruling that cheerleading does not currently qualify as a collegiate sport and that Quinnipiac University cannot count the members of its cheerleading squad towards their Title IX obligations. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Follow-Up Friday continues with tar balls. We've all heard the stories about tar balls washing up on the beaches throughout the Gulf Coast since the BP oil spill. On Tuesday, Brian spoke with Sandra Averhart, news director at public radio station WUWF in Pensacola, Florida. She described how her local beaches were affected. Take a listen.
The tar balls often get covered in sand, and so you don't really see a tar ball, a brown tar ball, necessarily. You may. It may be covered in sand, and you may not see it.
And then there it is between your toes.
And then there it is, stuck on your heel, which I did experience myself.
That was Brian Lehrer speaking with Sandra Averhart at public radio station WUWF earlier this week. During that segment, a few comments about tar and sand came into our website on the Brian Lehrer page at WNYC.org. Smokey wrote, I grew up in Corpus Christi, and every time I came back from Padre Island beginning in 1950, I came home with tar on my feet. Everybody did. It comes right off with baby oil. Joining us for a little tar ball follow-up is Thomas Shirley, endowed chair at the Hart Research Institute for Gulf of Mexico Studies, Texas A&M University, Corpus Christi. Dr. Shirley, welcome to WNYC.
Good morning.
And listeners, if you grew up along the Gulf or anywhere else, you'd find tar balls on the beaches. Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Dr. Shirley, what do you make of Smokey's comment? Many of us in the Northeast, some of us might not have heard of tar balls until the last month, but are they, in fact, something that has been around for a long time?
Probably since the beginning of time.
That's a long time.
That's right. There are approximately 1,500 natural oil and gas seeps in the Gulf of Mexico. There's a lot of oil here, and because of that, there's a lot of natural seeps. And the residue of the oil, as it begins to, the volatiles begin to evaporate, are tar balls. They've been reported from the earliest navigators into the Gulf of Mexico, the Spanish navigators through the Gulf in the early 1500s recorded tar balls in their ship's logs.
So are these essentially the same as the ones that are washing up now, and are the ones that are there more of them? I mean, what is causing this sort of increased concern?
Well, the tar balls that are washing up along the Florida coast and also in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana are the product of the deep horizon oil blowout. And as the oil weathers and the volatiles gas off, well, the oil develops into mousse and into ultimately tar. And this tar is very similar to what you would see in asphalt.
And, is it that there are more of them now, or is it just that people are paying attention?
Well, there are certainly more of them as a result of this large volume of oil released by the Deep Horizon oil well blowout. But there have always been tar balls as a result of natural seeps, and the numbers and their distribution varies over time, and it depends upon mainly upon currents and wind directions and things like that.
Are they dangerous? Should someone be worried if they step in one?
You should try to get it off. Most of the toxic materials have gone, but some of the residues are still toxic, yes. So you should try to wipe them off.
With baby oil, it's like the commenter said?
Baby oil works. Many of the different kinds of cleansers work. Early on, when I first started coming to the beach along the Texas coast, many of the motels and hotels would have little cleaning pads that were free in every room for you to wash the tar balls off before you came into the room, so you would not track in tar on their carpets.
Let's take some calls. Ellen from Garden City. Hi, you're on WNYC.
Oh, hi.
Hi, Ellen.
I grew up in New York. I was born in the Bronx and lived in Queens, and we used to go to Rockaway. And there were tar balls on the beach at Rockaway in the late 40s and early 50s. I don't know if they still have tar balls, but you used to walk off the beach with tar on your feet.
Did that bother you?
I was a little girl. Maybe it bothered my mother. I wasn't happy, but, it came off.
All right.
But there were tar balls there.
Thank you, Ellen. Let's take a very quick call from JC in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I remember getting lots of tar on our feet in the 70s in Virginia Beach, but we didn't know about the baby oil trick. So,
all right. Thank you very much. And we're getting a lot of calls from people who have stepped in tar balls as children. So I guess this is something that we will be watching. But I guess if you live in the Gulf, bring a supply of baby oil. Dr. Thomas Shirley, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure thing. Nice. Thanks for the invitation.
Sure. Dr. Thomas Shirley is the endowed chair at the Hart Research Institute for Gulf of Mexico Studies, Texas A&M University, Corpus Christi. Thanks for joining us. I'm Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC, WNYC.org, and that's your follow-up Friday. Except for this one last critical follow-up. Follow-up, remember the story of the 300 geese that were exterminated in Prospect Park? Well, a new group has moved in. 28 new geese were spotted there earlier this week. That's all for today. Brian's on vacation for the next 2 weeks. Lots of great guest hosts filling in for him. Isaac Davy Aronson, Amy Eddings, David Brancaccio. And I'll be back for one day in there as well. So stay tuned. Lisa Allison, Jody Avergan, Paige Cowett, and Rachel Senator produced this program with Alana Casanova-Burgess. We had intern help today from Janet Kim and Peter Moskowitz. The senior producer for the show is Megan Ryan. And our program director is Chris Bannon. That's Dimitri Krasny at the audio controls. I'm Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer. Have a great weekend, everyone. By the way, Mike on the comments page writes, I grew up in Southern California, and yes, certain beaches were known for tar. Carpinteria in particular, you would always get a drip or two on your feet or suit. It was mostly just a pain. I suspect the huge amount of tar in the Gulf may not be the same sort of thing in terms of quantity. The conversation continues on our comments page, WNYC.org. Go to the Brian Lehrer page. Thanks, everyone.